This is a download from the BBC. To find out more and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
This is James Kamarasamy with NewsHour, recorded on Monday the 4th of May at 13 hours GMT. Children are killed as a school is bombed in the Syrian city of Aleppo. The opposition blames the government. We have dramatic testimony.
Their class was hit on top of their heads, so they were very much scared. I could hear their screams even from my house.
US police shoot dead two gunmen who opened fire outside a centre hosting a competition for cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Israel's president says violent protests by Ethiopian Jews have exposed a bleeding wound at the heart of Israeli society. And
I forget sometimes, I'm just what my name says. Big bird is a big bird.
Playing a feathered friend for 40 years. First, though, after more than 4 years of Syria's relentless civil war, the bombing of civilians may no longer have the power to surprise, but, as you're about to hear, it does still have the power to shock even those who experience the horrors on a regular basis. On Sunday, at least four primary school children in the city of Aleppo were among a group of civilians who were killed when a playground was struck by what opposition activists say was a barrel bomb dropped from a government helicopter. Zeyna Erheim is a journalist in Aleppo. She works as the Syria Project Coordinator for the international NGO, the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
It happened two buildings away from mine. I think 9 a.m. we heard the first barrel bomb, but it hit a little bit further, so we went back sleeping as usual. But then another one hit so harsh, so my windows were broken, all the doors were opened, so we knew it's close, and then we started hearing the screaming, so we went into the streets. We found out that it hit an education center, and in front of it was a nursery. So then the civil defense, the White Hamlets, came with medics. All the men in the neighbor came to help. The talkie-walkies of the nearby checkpoints were all screaming, "Don't gather, the helicopter is still in the sky, and they might hit again." Sorry.
No, of course, it must have been terribly upsetting. I don't know if you can describe for us what you saw.
Okay, so I didn't get closer. I can't see bodies. So I stood at the beginning of the street, and they were mainly taking kids out of the rubbers, out of the wreckage, and they were moving them. Some of them were still alive. Some of them were had minor injuries. So they took them all into two field hospitals so their families can find them. And then I, when they finished evacuating the injuries and the kids, I came closer. They were still looking for a teacher and one little girl. I just saw the families. I saw the mothers who were just coming unconsciously asking about their kids. We didn't know what to tell them because we couldn't know who was injured, who was killed. It was so chaotic. And then the helicopter hit again. So we had all to just evacuate the area. Only civil defense kept working. We hid it in buildings. And then when it's gone, we went back again. I was filming. I couldn't be helping, but I saw more than five children who were, some of them were alive. They were faceless. They were just not crying, not doing anything. One little kid who had a face injury, he refused to leave the location because his brother is still inside. And the fathers I saw too, who just came seeking any news about their kids. Yeah, and most of the nursery kids were fine, but they were very close to the barrel bomb, and their class was hit above their heads. So they were very much scared. I could hear their screams even from my house. And then the rescuing procedure kept on, I believe, until noon. Then they found the bodies that they're looking for. And then I knew from the hospitals that 10 people I think more than 6 of them are kids, were killed in this attack. And it's not the first one. Last month, a barrel bomb hit Saad al-Ansari school, which is also very close. It's in Al-Mashhad. And it killed also tens of pupils and teachers. So now there are new rules that's going to be applied on schools to reduce the amount of classes because it's becoming too dangerous to go to school.
You said that you had got used in a way to hearing the sounds of these bombs. You went back to sleep after the first one struck, but clearly you're not getting used to seeing these kind of terrible, terrible sights.
No, I've been living here for like long enough to get used to the sounds, but not children getting killed while doing their exams. And their families, like the faces of their mothers while they were just searching and asking whether their kids are still alive or killed or on the wreckage. I don't know, the whole scene is really indescribable. I wouldn't be able to say anything about it. It's just so horrific.
But parents are still sending their children to schools, are they, despite what's been happening over the last month or so?
After the Saad al-Ansari massacre, the Saad al-Ansari school massacre, they stopped for a while, but then they went back to sending them to the schools, and now this happened, so I think this will also affect the ability for the parents to send their kids to school. But this has been happening for like 2-3 years if everyone get his kids out of the schools. So this is also not the solution. Although many of the schools, even those were not in the high floors, they were just in the first floor or basement, but this doesn't prevent you from getting buried in the wreckage. So I don't know what the solution is, but they're just feeling so helpless that you can't do anything. After the massacre, I was filming with one of my characters, and we went to her school in Old Aleppo. And all the kids were speaking about what had happened earlier with the other school, and they were saying that their families maybe wouldn't allow them to go tomorrow, and they don't know what to do. They asked the teacher whether she can come to their houses to give them the classes, but it's exams time. If they couldn't pass this, they wouldn't be able to join the class next year. So this is what's happening.
And you say people there feel abandoned? They really don't know how to react to this, despite all the condemnations of the use of barrel bombs, which of course are outlawed. It appears that they are continuing to be used.
They haven't stopped, not even for a day, for so long. So I really don't remember just one day where we had peace, clear sky, unless it's raining or clouds. And sadly, now it's summer. I wish we had the London weather so we wouldn't have these jets all the time. So it hasn't stopped. It's getting intensified. I haven't slept yet. Maybe that's why I'm kind of terrible in my language, because the attacks were on the whole night. I'm still in the corridor of my house. I was not able to move into the rooms. It's raining mortars. The jets were getting so much close at night, and many barrel bombs hit around the areas that I'm living at. I don't know. I've been here for so long, but last night was the worst I've ever had. So it is getting worse. I don't know what the condemnation is giving. In the ground, from my point of view, everything is just getting worse. The civilians are just getting more horrific scenes. They're just living a worse hell, but there is nothing getting better at all.
And the work you're doing, does it feel that you're able to get the message out?
I think the message is out, but no one wants to get it. No one can do anything about it. I don't know. But I think all the videos, everything that is available online. Yesterday, one of the white hamlets was killed while trying to help the others. And we had many citizen journalists who were killed trying to get the message out. But then this all is kind of in vain because there is no action.
Are you going to stay in Aleppo?
I believe so. But I don't know until when.
Journalist Zeina Erheim there. Well, story of one tragedy there, but how does it fit into the wider picture of what's happening in Aleppo? Sebastian Usher is our Arab Affairs editor.
Well, Aleppo for the past 3 years militarily has been in a kind of stalemate, a divided city. On the west, it's in government hands. The east is in rebel hands. Now, it's the east that has suffered most, as we're hearing there from Zeina from the barrel bombs. It's estimated about 3,000 people were killed by barrel bombs just last year. But recently, the rebels have been revivified by their gains over to the northwest in Idlib province, which is some distance away from Aleppo, but it has an important influence on the way they see Aleppo. And they've been trying to break this stalemate by launching a new offensive. Groups have come together, mostly Islamist groups, but not including Islamic State, ISIS. And they have been, to some extent, copying the tactics of the government. Now, they don't have the helicopter gunships that the government uses to drop these improvised bombs, these devastating bombs, essentially. And these barrel bombs are indiscriminate, and they have shrapnel in them to cause a maximum damage. But the rebels have been using shelling with something that has become known as a hell cannon, which does a similar thing to what these barrel bombs have done. And for the first time in some time, the communities in the West, some of the Christian communities there, for example, feel very much under attack. They've had losses recently. And I think this is where the re-intensification, you heard from Zeina there, that the situation is getting worse. And I think that's definitely true in the past month or two, having had a slightly quieter winter where people were, even on the eastern side, were beginning to try. The people who were left, about 40,000, were trying to lead a relatively normal life in these incredible circumstances, are now facing the same kind of campaign of barrel bombs in revenge from a government that they faced in previous years.
In a way, of course, it's immaterial to those who are caught up in all of this, but is this intensification then a sign of government weakness or strength, or is it impossible to say?
Well, if you look at what's happening now in the whole of the country, for the first time in quite a long time, people are thinking that President Assad is coming under pressure again. As I was saying, in Idlib province in the northwest, in the south, these combined rebel groups, which are getting increased funding again from the Saudis, from other groups, are presenting a much stronger and more unified opponent to his troops, which have always been very stretched, even more so now. They have problems with recruitment, with new people to replace those who've been killed. So there is a sense, as I say, that there is an opening for the rebels, and Aleppo is the place that they may be looking at now. The thing is, big question is, can the government accept that they lose Aleppo? In the long term, if they lost Aleppo, this will have Damascus, this will have a province near that, a heartland. But to lose Aleppo could be the moment that they lose the faith and the trust of the people who are still with them. So they will fight very, very hard to keep what they have there.
And that was our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up later on in the programme, at the tender age of 81, we asked the puppeteer behind Big Bird when he plans to hang up his feathers.
I'm having so much fun. I don't feel mentally like I'm an old man. I still play a six-year-old on television. I think I'm probably the world's oldest child star.
I'm really only 6 years old, so I feel pretty young.
We'll have more from Big Bird and indeed Oscar the Grouch later on in the programme. Now a reminder of our main headlines at this hour. Israel's president says that violent protests by Ethiopian Jews have exposed a bleeding wound at the heart of Israeli society. And the authorities in Texas are trying to identify two gunmen who were shot dead when they tried to attack a contest to draw cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kamara-Sami, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. We head, though, now to the Arctic Circle, to a ship stuck in the ice. No, this isn't a story about an unfortunate group of sailors and attempts to rescue them. It is, in fact, the tale of a mission with implications for the whole of mankind, because the ship is the base for a group of scientists who are carrying out research on the ice and on what is happening in the depths below. And as our science editor David Shookman reports, what they've discovered could have profound implications for our predictions about climate change.
I'm now walking over the frozen Arctic Ocean. Ahead of me, a scientist carrying a device that's measuring the thickness of the snow. That's the beep you can hear. And ahead of her, another scientist dragging a sledge carrying a device measuring the thickness of the ice. The scientists struggle to get their sledge over a ridge. The research is taking place around a ship, the Lancer, which since January has been deliberately jammed into the ice. Towering over the endless bright landscape, the vessel is at the centre of what is in effect a small campus, all kinds of researchers working 500 miles from the North Pole. The sound of a diver swimming below the ice. We can hear his breaths relayed back up to the surface. I'm sitting beside a rectangular hole cut into the ice. One of the diver's colleagues is standing watch, holding a lifeline. The divers here are biologists, and they're getting under the ice to understand better the life down there, how it works, and how it may be changing. The diver returns to the surface. What's caught everyone's attention here is a shift in the nature of the ice, with much less of the older, tougher stuff that lasts for several years and more younger ice that's thinner. Håkon Hopp of the Norwegian Polar Institute.
There's a major change, of course, in the Arctic Ocean because of the declining sea ice. And then the sea ice is getting thinner, and what used to be an ocean of multi-year ice is now mainly an ocean of first-year ice. The ice floe we are sitting on right now is 1.3 meters thick. Typically, there's much less life underneath first-year ice. So what has been seen around the Arctic is that these animals that live underneath the ice, the biodiversity of those have gone down.
Beside the ship, a rifle is loaded. In the world of the polar bear, the researchers need to be guarded. That's one challenge. Another is working in what feels like a freezer. Today it's minus 21 Celsius. Later, the wind chill makes it feel minus 47. But the Norwegian Polar Institute organised this expedition because so little is known about the Arctic in the coldest months. Jan Gunnar Winter is the Institute's director.
So what's unique with this expedition is especially that we are here in winter, and we started in January. Cold, dark, basically almost no data available from the Arctic Ocean, with a few exceptions. So this information is very important to be able to understand the processes when ice is freezing in the early winter, and we will also stay here when the ice melts. And the Arctic is, in a way, a new era has entered. We are going from old ice to young ice, thinner ice, and the climate models used today, they have not captured in them this new regime or ice situation.
Hey, I've reached ice!
Yeah, you can do it!
I lend a hand digging into the snow. Some polar science is high-tech with satellites, some is low-tech work with a shovel. Polona Itkin is installing tracking devices to keep watch on the ice.
It tells me where it is, how thick is the ice at that position, and how deep is the snow there.
And you have a network of these things?
Yes.
The instrument is lowered into the ocean. The Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the planet, but the ice will not vanish overnight, because winters will always be freezing here. But what the researchers are finding with the thinning of the ice and the response of the animals is evidence of a dramatic transformation.
David Shookman reporting there. Now, at least two people have been killed in Bujumbura, the capital of Burundi during protests against the decision by President Pierre Nkurunziza to stand for a third term. Six people died during clashes with police last week. The small African country in the Great Lakes region has been largely peaceful since a 12-year civil war officially ended a decade ago, but that stability seems to be wobbling. Waving sticks and branches, protesters held handwritten signs and chanted slogans critical of the government. This man explained why he had joined the rally.
As you can see, I'm here to protest the president's seeking of a third term. I will only leave here when Nkurunziza says he will not run in the upcoming presidential elections.
Well, let's speak now to the BBC's Maud Julien, who is in Bujumbura. Maud, what have you been able to see today?
Well, there were several protests in at least four districts of the capital today. Each time, large groups of several hundred people clashed with policemen. I was in one area during most of the morning, Musaga, and there were over 1,000 people during the first few hours of the day. They were peacefully protesting. There were many women among them. But towards midday, some protesters started throwing rocks at the police, and the security forces replied with tear gas and live ammunition. A lot of rounds were fired. There should be a lot of casualties emerging in the next few hours. For now, we know at least six people were severely wounded and two policemen on top of that. We also saw one man be carried away with a wound to the chest.
And the protesters, very clear what they want or don't want. They don't want the president to stand for a third term. What is the government saying about this?
Well, the president claims that he's only been elected once, which is actually true because for his first mandate, he was nominated, not elected. And the country's constitution says that any president can only serve two elected mandates in power. So the ruling party and the president are using that argument to justify his candidacy, which, of course, protesters contest. They point to the Arusha Agreement, which is a founding text in Burundi, which clearly states that no more than 2 5-year mandates can be served by each president.
What kind of support does the president have for his plan?
Well, the president seems to be losing support by the day. Not only is there dissidence inside his ruling party, but there's also been positioning that's been there's also been declarations from the army that have gone against a third mandate for President Nkurunziza. Over the weekend, the defense minister called on all parties to comply with the Arusha Agreement. So the president is in a weak position at the moment. He's been criticized by the international community, inside his own party, and by his army.
Maud, thanks very much. That's the BBC's Maud Julien there in the capital of Burundi, Bujumbura, bringing us up to date on the latest violence that's been taking there between protesters unhappy at that decision by the president to stand for another term and the police. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kamara-Sami, and this is NewsHour. Coming up next, relief agencies speak of difficulties in bringing aid to Nepal. First, though, our daily look at the world of business. And the European Commission says that there were constructive talks over the weekend between Greece's international creditors and the Greek government, as that country's new left-wing administration tries to avoid bankruptcy whilst honouring its electoral promises of extra spending on pensions, wages and social benefits. And that means that, as well as the international dimension, the Greek debt crisis is having a local impact, as Paul Moss reports from Athens.
It's an unlikely place for an outbreak of rebellion. The headquarters of Athens Regional Council is a pretty banal building, certainly set against the grandeur elsewhere in this city, both ancient and modern. But the Greek government has decreed that all local authorities must now transfer whatever money they have to the central bank to help keep the country financially afloat. Councillor George Koumoutsakos from the opposition New Democracy Party says they'll fight this demand by arguing it's unconstitutional.
It was a big and negative surprise. that all of a sudden we had to accomplish our mission and duties without money, actually. I think the Syriza government lacks the necessary experience how to run a country. I do hope that bankruptcy will not happen.
But bankruptcy is precisely what many are fearing for Greece right now. Demand for local government cash, just one indication of the country's financial plight. Greece has multi-billion euro debt repayments falling due this month and next. But negotiations to get more financial help from the EU and IMF seem to be going nowhere.
Financial obligations have deadlines that have to be met. The money is not forthcoming.
Vangelis Akapitos is a Greek economist. He says that contrary to its spendthrift image, the new Syriza government has balanced the books when it comes to public spending. But that's no longer enough for financial survival.
Greece has a primary surplus. What this means is that they collect enough money from their taxes to pay off the salaries and other public expenses. What they do not have enough money is to service their debt. It's that money that Greece doesn't have.
Syriza's national offices are in a rather noisy, rundown building in a rundown part of Athens, an expression of the party's efforts to work and identify with the people they represent. I talked there to the Syriza spokesman, Yanis Bournos, and asked him whether perhaps their victory in the Greek election might perhaps have raised public expectations just a little too high.
Actually, I don't think that too much was promised. The government already has moved with the first legislative initiatives, which offers free electricity, housing allowance and nutrition allowance to families living in extreme poverty conditions.
But are you worried about this country going bankrupt?
The new Greek government has clearly stated that it respects its duties towards the institutions. At the same time, in case that we have to choose between paying salaries and pensions and repaying our debt installments, we will choose the first.
Syriza spokesman Yanis Bournos, ending that report by Paul Moss in Athens. A contingent of American troops and helicopters is expected to join in the rescue and recovery operations in Nepal today. It's now known that more than 7,000 people have died as a result of the earthquake, while many more are still waiting for assistance. The government in Kathmandu has said that most of the rescue work has been completed. But as the BBC's Anu Anand has been finding out, it's acknowledged that the rebuilding work will take a long time.
We've come to the town of Sangachok. It's in the worst affected district in Nepal, and most of the houses in this little town have simply disappeared off the side of the hill. Even the stronger homes that are made of brick and concrete have very serious structural damage. You can see giant cracks running through them. I'm just standing next to the site of a three-story building. It's gone. I mean, it's just a pile of debris, dusty, rough wooden beams, roof tiles, crumpled sheets of tin. And a group of Nepalese police and army are sifting through the rubble by hand. You can hear them, they're pulling out pieces of the building to stack up on the other side of the road. They're just pulling a large section right across this little road that runs through the town. There's a bus screeching to halt. The dust is pretty amazing. And some of the soldiers are standing on top of what's left of the house. They're breaking apart the wooden beams that would have held up the roof. They're stacking up the tiles. And the point is to try and recover whatever belongings they can salvage for those people who lived in these houses. This lady here, it was one of the residents of this building. She says that she ran a cosmetic shop in this building for 12 years, and there was something like 12 people who lived in the building as a whole. I've asked her why she wants the soldiers to dig through this immense mountain of rubble, and she says that whatever was in that building, whatever money, whatever cosmetics, whatever belongings, that's all she has. And if they can recover anything, she'll be very happy. I'm just going to speak to one of the soldiers who's helping out here. He says that he's been helping dig out bodies and helping dig out belongings now for the past 9 days, even though his own home in his village is in a very bad condition. He says that the most distressing thing for him has been digging through the houses and finding the bodies of children, the bodies of the elderly, those who were too weak to run to escape this tragedy. And he says that he's so far dug through the remains of at least 30 houses here.
Anu Anand there. Well, earlier I spoke to Anu and I put it to her that, as the soldier she spoke to there illustrates, in a disaster of this scale, the rescuers are often victims as well.
That's right. So many people are caught up in this together. And it's not just victims of an earthquake. I mean, the thing that we're seeing and hearing so powerfully is that the people here, such a large majority of Nepal's population is desperately poor. We were in a village not very far from Kathmandu first thing this morning, and we were hearing that, you know, their houses are more or less intact, but they're very damaged. And with the rains coming, they could fall down. And also that, you know, in a normal time, they only grow enough food to survive, to feed themselves for half a year. They have to work, they have to do odd jobs the rest of the time. So you can imagine how much this earthquake has thrown an already poor country into chaos. I'm standing in a tiny little village on a hilltop in Sindhupalchok, which is the worst affected area. I just interviewed an entire family sitting on the rubble of their house. The roof has collapsed on that house, and that's where they're sheltering. They're sheltering under the roof that was once, you know, three stories up. It's now inches above their head. And they're waiting. People are simply waiting. They're just not clear on whether or not enough food or enough medicines or supplies or shelter, tents really, that's the big thing, whether those things are going to come through in time before the monsoon.
And what sense are you getting from rescue workers, from officials, from international aid operations who are there on the ground about the extent to which the government can cope with this?
Well, first of all, just to say that in the 5 or 6 hours we've been going through this particular district so far, we're seeing a few vehicles, a few World Food Programme vehicles, one UN vehicle, a lot of private aid, just vans filled with rice and other supplies that are being given out. But aid workers here, both private and the UN, are clearly frustrated with the lack of clarity from the government. And I heard very much that sentiment from Imam Kasim, who's with the Al Khair Foundation, which is a UK-based charity.
We're working on shelter, on medical. Hopefully within 2-3 days we will be having medical supplies here for about 125,000 patients. Similarly, tents, whole cargo is coming, good quality tents, which will last not only through this emergency, but the monsoon season, very heavy rain season, as well as possibly winter, focusing on disability support, on education, re-establishment of schools, and so on.
And what the Imam really means by that is that they have relief supplies stuck at the airport, at Kathmandu Airport. And they're stuck because there's no clarity on what the government requires in terms of customs. Are they going to charge import duties, for example, even on relief supplies? They haven't been clear about it. Or if they've been clear at high-level meetings, that message is not getting down to the personnel that are manning the borders, the airports, etc. There was also a rumor earlier this week that the government was going to require all foreign aid money coming in to go through some kind of a government fund. Now, that's actually not true. But again, the lack of clarity has meant that those NGOs did not transfer the money to Nepal to get materials bought and distributed. So the lack of clarity in this operation, as well, of course, as the terrible logistics, the bad roads, the lack of capacity, is really holding up this aid effort.
Anu Anand there in Nepal. A video emerges showing police beating a man of African descent. The local community reacts angrily. Demonstrators take to the streets. Eventually, there are confrontations between the protesters and the forces of law and order, in which both sides sustain injuries. And if you think this sounds familiar, think again. This isn't a tale from an American city, but from Israel. The protesters were members of the country's Ethiopian community who took to the streets of Tel Aviv. The video showed the beating of an Israeli soldier of Ethiopian descent. Well, Mickey Rosenfeld, a spokesman for the Israeli police, said the police had already taken action against the officer in question.
Since that specific event, the police officer himself was removed from duty and in fact fired from the Israeli police force already 4 days after that event. In general, the Israeli police have made preparations and dealt with a number of different disturbances that have continued, and that's after that specific and one-off event that took place.
Well, Israel's president, Reuven Rivlin, said that mistakes had been made in Israel's treatment of Ethiopian Jews, but he warned against further violence.
Protest is an essential tool in democracy, but violence is not the way and not the solution. The demonstrators and police acted with restraint, and that is worth noting. We must not let a small violent rioting group silence the legitimate cry.
The deputy mayor of Tel Aviv, Meheretta Baruch Ron, who is of Ethiopian descent, was at the demonstration on Sunday. She said that she too had experienced discrimination.
Everyone who attended the protest yesterday has experienced at one point in his life or her life some kind of humiliation based on nothing but the color of his skin. I, the deputy mayor of Tel Aviv, can tell you that myself from my own experience. When I turned up to attend the event yesterday at the square, a policewoman stood at the entrance and asked me who I was. I said, I'm the deputy mayor of Tel Aviv and I need to enter the VIP section. She said, it's good that you didn't find yourself a fancier title, and then just didn't let me in.
So what's the background to this flare-up of tensions? Our Middle East correspondent Kevin Connolly is in Jerusalem.
Well, the story of the Ethiopian-Israeli community is, of course, an extraordinary one. It starts with what I suppose you'd call one of Zionism's most exotic ventures. These people from a small religious minority in Ethiopia were brought in a series of airlifts beginning in the 1980s, and they came to Israel to reclaim their Jewish heritage. And it was seen as a remarkable piece of political vision by the Israeli authorities at the time, and as a remarkable logistical achievement in, of course, what were very difficult times in Ethiopia. But the social problems that you've been hearing about there and the political issues that come with them, they really, I think, stem from the fact that the Ethiopian-Israeli population feels that somehow its treatment, once it was here in the country, never matched the generosity and the romance or the impulse that brought them here. So, in effect, they were brought here. They came from a very disadvantaged society. They had, for example, very poor educational standards, and that made it hard for them to integrate. They believe that they're viewed in a racist way, they're discriminated against, and that they have been brought here on that extraordinary historical journey, but brought here, in effect, to be a disadvantaged minority.
What about the official reaction now? We heard there from the president, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's also getting involved. He's holding a meeting, I think, with the soldier who was beaten.
The trigger for the last week's violence, Jamie, was this very, very painful video which showed the young soldier, Damis Picada, being beaten quite violently by the police. There's no sound on the tape, but it doesn't look so there's anything which would remotely justify police aggression. Now, that young soldier has today been introduced to Benjamin Netanyahu. We've already seen television pictures showing Mr. Netanyahu talking about feeling mortified when he saw those pictures and expressing the hope that some good could come of it. Now, anyone who's seen the pictures of the overnight political violence in Tel Aviv will see that the police, the Israeli police, put that violence down with some force. There were mounted police charges, there were water cannons deployed and stun grenades, so that the security response was very firm. But the political response has been very different. Reuven Rivlin talked about an open wound in Israeli society. Benjamin Netanyahu talked about the hope that somehow good might come from this, so that the political response has been notably conciliatory in tone. They recognise the anger in this Ethiopian-Israeli community. I don't think they have a quick fix for it, a short-term answer, but they want to be seen to be making the right noises. And in effect, Israel is admitting, I suppose, that the grievances of this Ethiopian minority are real and are genuine.
That was our Middle East correspondent, Kevin Connolly. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Now let's hear from Texas, where police say that they have shot dead two armed men who fired at a security officer after driving up to a venue hosting a controversial contest featuring cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The organisers of the event, a conservative political group highly critical of Islam, had offered a $10,000 prize for the winning cartoon. The event was held in a Dallas suburb amid high security. It was addressed by the Dutch politician Geert Wilders, known for his strong anti-Islam views. The mayor of Garland, where the shooting took place, says the event didn't reflect the character of his town.
Of course, we'd have been happy if they'd stayed in New York and had their activity there, but they chose to come here. From all reports I've gotten from our officers that were on the scene, most of the people there were not from Garland. They were not even from Texas. So this does not involve Garland. Garland was just named one of the most diverse cities in the United States, number 9 on that list. Our neighborhoods were judged the 5th most diverse neighborhoods in the country. We speak 114 languages in our school district. We're extremely diverse. We have no ethnic majority. And so Garland was not participating in this as a city in any shape, fashion. This is an outside group that just happened to pick our city for their event.
One of the organizers of the controversial contest was Pamela Geller. For her, the shooting supports their reasons for holding the Muhammad art exhibit, as it was called. She's not impressed by the mayor's concerns.
How ridiculous. I mean, that's like saying that the pretty girl was responsible for her own rape. The mayor is going after the defenders of free speech and clearly giving a free pass to the savages who came with guns to kill innocent people because of a cartoon. This incident shows how very much needed our event really was. Freedom of speech is under violent assault here in our country. The question now before us is, will we stand and defend it or bow to violence, thuggery, and savagery?
Pamela Geller, one of the organisers of that exhibition, encouraging people to draw pictures of the Prophet Muhammad in Texas. Just to repeat, two gunmen have been shot dead. We'll bring you more information on their identities when we get it. Now, a change of pace and tone, because fans of Sesame Street, one of the world's most popular children's television shows, might be surprised to learn that Big Bird, the super-sized sunshine-coloured bird, and Oscar, the trash-can-dwelling grouch, are played by the same man. He is 81-year-old Carol Spinney, and he tells his story in a new film called I Am Big Bird, a title that will surely give Oscar something else to grouch about. Well, in the film, he talks about his brush with death. Big Bird was initially offered a place on the doomed space shuttle Challenger before NASA decided that he wouldn't fit, and about his experience of childhood bullying. But he began his interview with the BBC's Seema Kotecha by explaining that his career had its origins in his mother's childhood in the north of England.
Sunny day, sleeping up. I've been a puppeteer since I was a little boy. My mother was born in Bolton. We used to go to Blackpool to see Punch and Judy shows. She saw I had an interest in puppets, so she built me a Punch and Judy show for my 9th birthday. She put 9 puppets, Punch and Judy and the Policeman, etc., and a theater that was just covered over with a blanket. I couldn't tell what it was until she revealed it. What a Christmas present. She didn't realize she was giving me my career. Can you tell me how to get
to Sesame Street? Obviously, these characters are watched by millions of children around the world.
Yes.
What impact do you think they've had on popular culture?
Well, lately, because of a lot of promotion of the film I Am Big Bird, I've gotten a lot of feedback, and people said that Big Bird and even Oscar's gotten praised for how much they helped change their life. I couldn't imagine how Big Bird, he's sensitive and complex a character, and the children were able to identify with him. But with Oscar, I was amazed when I started hearing positive feedback with him, in that he, sometimes I would do a scene with him and I'd say, he's so awful. Why is he good on this show? I wanted to continue doing him, but they said, well, it takes all kinds to make a world. Maybe that's one of the answers. Oh, I
something dirty or dingy or dusty.
No matter how grouchy I am, they keep hanging around my trash can, bothering me. I say, scram, beat it, leave me alone, but they just stand there.
I love it because it's trash.
There was a period where you weren't very happy with what you were doing, is that right?
Well, mostly the problem was the pay was rather low and I had no place to stay because apartments were more expensive than the pay allowed. I started in one and when I got my first paycheck after taxes, there wasn't enough to pay the rent on the place, so they asked for a lot of money so I can get out of the lease. After that, I slept on people's couches and any place I could find to sleep. And it seemed rather strange because Big Bird within a year was quite famous even in other countries. And we picked up more countries as we went through the time.
Let's take a break, Elmo.
Take a break? Well, why, Big Bird?
Well, I'm tired, Elmo. We've been playing tag all morning.
But Elmo's having fun, Big Bird.
Me too, but taking a break is fun, too.
It is?
I'm taking a break.
Oh.
Taking a rest.
Big Bird.
Taking some time.
Did you ever get bored? Did you ever think,
no.
Oh, you know, I'm playing these two characters this period of time?
No, it was so much fun because when you're playing them and manipulating them at the same time I recorded the words, and I felt that I was living Big Bird's life a little bit, and Oscar the Grouch was a character who was rather amazing that he was on a show for children because he's quite an irritable person and fun to play. I was never cool in school, but he's been described as cool to me many times. And so I kind of got a kick out of that. Right, Oscar? Yeah, a lot of fun. I never have fun.
I forget sometimes. I'm just what my name says. Big Bird is a big bird.
Well, my name's Imogene, Big Bird. Glad to meet you. Oh, and by the way, I got a package here for Oscar the Grouch. Can you tell me where he lives?
Yeah, right in that trash can where you're standing.
How much longer do you want to continue playing these characters?
Well, we're 45 years in now. I'd like to do at least 50. I say at least because I'd like to do more than that if I'm still having a good time doing it. And at 50 years, I'll be 85 years old. And I'm having so much fun, I don't feel mentally like I'm an old man. I still play a six-year-old on television. I think I'm probably the world's oldest child star.
I'm really only 6 years old, so I feel pretty young.
He sounds it too. Carol Spinney there speaking to Seema Kotecha. This edition of News Hour brought to you by the letters J and C. From me, James Kimaraswamy, and the rest of the team, thanks for listening. Goodbye.